From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, giant crystals and UFO mysteries, a classic Coast to Coast show. Here's what's happening. A man in Thailand, oh my gosh, he videotaped himself killing his child and then himself, obviously, on Facebook Live, according to Thai police. The latest example of the social network's live streaming function being used to broadcast grisly, horrible crimes. A U.S. Navy destroyer had another close encounter with an Iranian Revolutionary Guard fast attack craft in the Persian Gulf. The two U.S. officials are saying that the Iranian ship came within 1,000 yards of the guided missile destroyer USS Mahan, with its weapons manned. Not a good thing at all. North Korea might be talking about building missiles that can reach the United States, but Kim Jong-un's regime already has lots of missiles that can reach Japan, so the Japanese government is preparing its citizens in a case of a missile coming their way, possibly with less than 10 minutes warning. The Prime Minister's office issued new actions to protect yourself guidelines this week, including for the first time, instructions on how to respond if a North Korean ballistic missile is heading toward Japan. Dr. Jerome Corsi from Infowars.com with us. Jerry, it still seems like it's heating up, doesn't it?
Very much so, George. And I think we're going to see any action I think that North Korea takes right now that's aggressive could lead to a U.S. military response. We're sending the THAAD anti-missile system to South Korea now, and President Trump is briefing all the Senate tomorrow at the White House on North Korea, which is really an unprecedented move. So it seems like, you know, there's planning clearly in the Pentagon for the possibility of military action. I continue to say it's very unpredictable, very dangerous, could lead to a regional war or even a global nuclear war if China got involved.
Well, then it seems like we're starting to slowly drum up some support from other countries. Case in point, the story I just had about Japan.
Well, and Japan has legitimate concerns. I mean, they might have a 10-minute warning if North Korea launched missiles at Japan, and in 10 minutes you're not going to be able to do much protection of the civilian population. So I think there's a lot of negotiations and a lot of behind-the-scenes going on since the premier of China met with President Trump at Mar-a-Lago a few weeks ago, and I see China getting more involved. The question is, I think, George, whether or not Kim Jong-un can stay rational enough, because any one move could be so provocative it would almost demand the military response, and that's what makes the situation so volatile and so dangerous.
Here's my psychic prediction, Jerry. Either a group from within North Korea will take him out, or we're going to go to war with him.
Well, the first is clearly the more, you know, the much preferable. Going to war with North Korea, I mean, I can see limited, you know, assaults or an attack to try to destroy the bases, but the idea of going to war again in North Korea is like a 1950s nightmare, and I don't see that it's really realistic in terms of any real progress or success in any short term. That's what makes it so difficult. This is going to be a very complicated situation, and even if there is a military strike, if it's limited, I'm not sure how effective it's going to be, and even a limited military strike could very quickly escalate.
Good point. Thank you, Jerry. Coca-Cola sales continue to fizzle, and the company is planning to cut 1,200 jobs just to try and get back on track. Meanwhile, though, U.S. equities, the stock market, rose pretty solidly because of several large companies rolling through good earnings reports. So it's been pretty strong at the stock market level. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mish Michael Shedlock on this. Mish, what do you think about what's happening? So far, so good.
Two things happened this week, George. The first was the French election. While it went as expected, it went the way the bureaucrats wanted, and the polls have been so unreliable. that no one knew the outcome, but it appears that the person that the EU wants, that most of Europe wants, is actually going to win round two, which is May 7th now. Then today we had a housing report that was actually quite solid, and so I upped my GDP forecast, ta-da, from 0.4% to 0.7%. The forecasts are all over the place, George. The Atlanta Fed is forecasting 0.5%. We'll see. They didn't comment on today's on the housing reports that came out. Zero Hedge is 0.8. Market, which is an ISM equivalent, 1.7. The First National Bank of New York, 2.7. And the Institute of Supply Management, 4.3. So there's your range, 0.5% to 4.3. I'm at the very low end of that. I upped it a little bit today. It does not look pretty today, but to me, and I've been pretty good on these GDP estimates, but George, the stock market has a different idea. It keeps rolling on.
And a quick thing, Mish, BB's, the women clothes store, closing all their stores. JCPenney continues to close stores. Payless Shoes closing stores. What's happening there?
George, we've talked about that before, and it is going to spill over. I don't know when, but how many these stores are all closing with minimum wages going up? There's less incentive to build stores. Amazon is absolutely crucifying all the brick-and-mortar stores. I still don't know where the jobs are going to come from. Especially, you know, we're a couple years away. Waymo is testing, that's the Google, testing for free in Phoenix today, self-driving taxis that are going to take people to work.
I'm not getting in one of those.
You know, I don't blame you. I love to drive, George, but there's a lot of people that are getting older, have impaired night vision. There's families that own two cars that might say, you know what, I think we can get by with one if we have this. These things start out slow. Someone emailed me today, said, Mish, you know, if all these electric cars and all this is a really good idea, then why don't we see it here now? And I didn't post it on my blog yet, but I'm going to tomorrow. It's going to be out there tonight. I've got a picture of New York in 1910, and a picture of New York City in 1920. It's all horses in 1910. There's not a horse to be found in 1920. These changes start out slow, and then they skyrocket. So I think this stuff's going to happen, George.
All right, Mish, thank you so much. Mish Shedlock, as he tells us things about the economy. Up next, let's go out into space. David Livingston back on Coast to Coast next. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. David Livingston, our guest for the first couple hours. Dr. Livingston is a founder and host of The Space Show, which focuses on space commerce, space tourism, facilitating our becoming a space-faring economy, and we will eventually. David is also an adjunct professor of space studies at the University of North Dakota. David, welcome back to the show. Always good to have you on. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. Thank you very much, George, and good to be talking with you again.
Matter of fact, I should update this. So you're still at the University of North Dakota?
I just finished a summer school class this past summer on Space 2017 and what to expect from the new administration.
Oh, that's exciting.
It was
stuff.
A lot of fun.
What did you think of the former administration in terms of its efforts with space?
I give them a mixed grade. So, you know, first of all, my filter is I wasn't supportive of the former administration on much of anything. But the one thing that they did do was they sort of took a back seat and allowed entrepreneurism and commercial space to get firmly rooted. And I give them credit for that insight. It was started with Bush and in the former administration with the COTS program to take commercial spaceships to the International Space Station, and it really took off under Obama. for a lot of different reasons, but a lot of that has to do with the technology of small satellites and Earth imaging technology that just has blossomed with very few barriers to entry. The ability to fund things through crowdfunding like Kickstarter, for example, lots of things entered into it, and that administration took a back seat and let it happen, and I think that's really good. SpaceX thrived, and we see the progress they're making. They're now starting to integrate reusable first stage flights in their flights. Blue Origin has all sorts of new rockets planned and is doing reusability too. Orbital ATK, which was a COTS winner, has done some pretty miraculous things with their flights to the space station for cargo. All of this really got birthed in the previous administration. So I give them high marks for entrepreneurism and commercial space development.
Give me your reaction, David, to China and their space effort. They seem to be coming along really fast.
Well, they are. Now, you know, the first thing to understand about China is it's a government program, and by government, it's really a Chinese military program. So everything is under the Chinese military. There isn't a commercial space sector or a private space sector or an independent agency or anything like that. So that said, they have some pretty lofty goals that they're, you know, going toward, and they're meeting them. So they want to have a presence on the moon. They want to have a presence on Mars. They want to have their own independent orbiting space station. And they're making progress in all of this. They're testing docking right now. That, you know, they're testing a lot of their orbital mechanics for their space station. They have had successful flights with a rover on the moon. So I'm impressed by the Chinese program. They've had Taikonauts up in space, and you know, they're a little bit ahead of, say, our Gemini level of technology. But they're fast learners. They've got good technology. They're motivated. They're spending whatever they need to spend in terms of capital on their space program. And as I said, they have goals, and they're going to reach those goals.
Well, you know, here we are almost 50 years after we landed on the moon for the first time. And at that time, really, not even the Russians were close to us in terms of being able to put somebody on the moon. Look at the 50-year head start we had on people, David. Now they seem to be catching up with us.
Well, I think they're still pretty far behind. But, yeah, they are moving. So keep in mind, they're a totalitarian government, and they can do whatever they want, and they don't have a Congress, and they don't have people, you know, that can pressure them, and they don't have lobby groups and, you know, all the stuff that we're subject to. And they don't have the diversity of programming that they need for their people and on the humanitarian side. And, you know, so it's a very different world for China. But they are really dedicated to technology, not just space, but you can see this in their military technology. I think they just launched an aircraft carrier today or something like that. They're very technologically oriented, and they are driven, and they can make decisions very quickly compared to a democracy. And they have the technology. They don't have to reinvent the wheel, George. We had to invent the wheel, as did the old Soviet Union. So, you know, that was a lot longer process to invent the wheel and test it and perfect it. They get to sort of copy what we did.
They've got our template, basically.
They've got our template, and they have the Soviet Union's template. And so, you know, they still have to test their hardware and their and perfect their programming and all of that. But it's a lot different. I mean, look, we've even got private companies now that are doing what China's doing. Now, China's doing it with human spaceflight. SpaceX and Boeing have not yet done it with human spaceflight, with the CST-100 on the Boeing side and the Dragon. But that's going to be in the next year or two. We're going to see the private companies matching and probably surpassing what China does with human spaceflight.
David, let's talk about the commercial rocket reusability. And, you know, right now, though it's been successful in some cases, it also has not been successful. And is it risky, unreliable? Where do you see it headed?
I think it is potentially the biggest game changer in accessing space that we have right now. But there is still reason to be skeptical, and there is still reason to ask some really hard questions. So SpaceX, for the first time, flew a reusable first stage. And it took them a year of analyzing and testing to go through those engines and to, you know, give it the okay to be able to do this. Now, clearly, if you're going to do this on a commercial basis, and they have another reusable flight coming up pretty quickly, you can't spend a year in the refurbishment line because that will take all your economics out of the question. So they've got to be able to have reliability in their turnaround systems and their analysis in order to make all of this work. And so far, in talks that Mr. Musk has given, he has said that the savings on reusability are maybe in the neighborhood of 10%. They're kind of marginal. But if they really start getting reusable flights on a lot of flights and they have customers willing to do it, and a big question is what the insurance rates will be on a reusable first stage and how and what those rates will be on the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth flight of the same reusable first stage, because we don't really know how many times you can successfully fly them or how what it's going to cost to economically maintain them on each subsequent flight. So these are all questions to be answered, but it's a game changer, and it holds out amazing promise to lower the cost of access to space. And as you lower the cost of access to space, you raise significantly the opportunities to do things in space. I got an email from a guy who's doing a Kickstarter program who wants to raise money, George, to build Earth-based, I think it's Earth-based telescopes to look for exoplanets. And why can he do that? He can do that because he sees that he can get a ride to space on an affordable rocket. And 5 years ago, affordability and a ride to space, you know, those two words don't go together.
Will there be competition in terms of pricing eventually?
Well, you've got two players. So you've got SpaceX and you've got Blue Origin. So right now, the new Shepard for Blue Origin is a suborbital vehicle. But remember, he wants to build the big orbital rockets, and he wants to compete with what SpaceX is doing. So I think, yes, there probably will be some competition. Now, ULA has a different version of reusability. I'm not sure how that model is going to hold up given the progress that SpaceX and Blue have made. So what the ULA wants to do is when the rocket is returning, when the stage is coming back to Earth, rather than recover the first stage, they want to recover the rocket engines. So they say, let's jettison those engines. They're the most expensive, complex part of this whole package. Let's get them back. Let's refurbish those and reuse those. We don't need the cylinder to get that back. You know, we can easily build another inexpensive tube to put the rocket engines in. So that's a little bit of a different concept. They have to snag those engines coming in on reentry in the air, which they've done, you know, with other kinds of experiments and things. But I have a feeling the SpaceX model and the Blue model are going to be the prevailing model. And yes, I think there will be some price competition, but right now you don't see it coming from Russia. They're not doing this yet. And Ariane Space, which is the biggest commercial provider of launch services in the world, they're not doing it, and they don't have plans to do it very quickly. And China doesn't have any reusability, nor does India. So I think your two players are going to be SpaceX and Blue for the time being. So I think there might be some price competition, but a lot will depend on refurbishment costs, timelines, and insurance.
Where do you see, David, the push in space? Do you think it's to find extraterrestrial life on other planets? Is it to mine asteroids? What do you think the main missions will be?
I wish I could say, George, it was to find extraterrestrial life, but I am one of those that would really like to be able to find some kind of extraterrestrial life, be it biological or molecular or something. But it just doesn't seem to me that you have the real push going to do that. For example, on the various probes that go to Mars, like Mars 2020 and other projects that are out there, you don't really see life detection equipment on the rovers. Now, when I asked the folks at NASA and JPL and Applied Physics over at the physics lab at Johns Hopkins, yeah, and they all say how hard it is to make life detection equipment.
Hold on for a second, David. We're already at the bottom of the hour, but we're coming back for more on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, David Livingston with us. So, David, you don't think the push will be to find extraterrestrial life, even though they tease us every once in a while with a discovery here and there? I really think they're going to push the mining of an asteroid because there's money involved. What do you think?
I don't think NASA will be pushing that, but the commercial industry is definitely interested in deep space mining, and there are two companies that are pushing it, and we're seeing different countries create some space policy, space law to try to partake in that type of industry. You've got Luxembourg, although there's some problems emerging there. You've got the UAE. You've got other countries around the world that are interested in this, but it's very, very long term, and there's a lot of reason to be skeptical of that industry and its economics too. And what we need here are a lot of policy and legal reforms to enable that industry, in addition to the technology and the financing to make it happen. But there are some parts of the models that trouble me as an economist, like returning resources to Earth is very, very costly. And the reason these things are valuable is because they're in short supply on Earth and they get high prices. So if you flood the market with something coming back, let's say platinum, from outer space, you have the potential to drive your platinum prices down on Earth. That makes going to get them in space a lot more costly, returning them to Earth a lot more costly. So then you end up with cartel activity like the De Beers diamond, thing to try.
Oh, my God, to control it, yeah.
So if you can use this stuff in space, I think there's a huge potential, but we're not even close to being that spacefaring yet. But the big issue here comes into the Outer Space Treaty and the fact that there simply are no property rights and no celestial body ownership. And this is very controversial. And
explain that, because...
So the Outer Space Treaty was done in 1967. There were two space countries at the time, the Soviet Union and the United States. Nobody ever dreamed of commercial space, private space, deep space. All of this was really foreign. I mean, it wasn't even in the consciousness of people. So, fast forward 50 years, and here we are today, and we've got some of the technology, and we've got the inspiration, and we've got some of the financing, but you are prohibited by treaty to own property. So how do you invest in, let's say, an asteroid to mine it, regardless of what you're going to do with the resources? Let's leave that aside for the moment. If you can't have a title to it. So the Outer Space Treaty doesn't allow ownership of any resources, but if you sort of set up a mining claim and you work the claim and you develop something, you're entitled to the revenue from that development, but you don't have any ownership rights. So if you think of how a project gets financed here on Earth, you usually get construction loans or you get short-term mortgages or financing, but you have some property that you collateralize to get that development financing. Well, there's nothing you can develop, you can collateralize in space because there's no property rights, there's no deed, there's no ownership. So it is a real problem how to do this, and it's prevented by the Outer Space Treaty. So now, what do you do about that?
And why did we sign it when we were so far ahead of everybody?
Well, it's got a lot of really great provisions in it that kept the Soviet Union and Russia at peace, the Soviet Union and the United States at peace in space. I mean, keep in mind, we didn't have any consciousness that there would ever be anything in space going on like there is now. Nobody thought about a space tourist. We were sending military people to space as astronauts, and the rockets were made in America by private companies, but they were made and, under the direction of the government and for the purpose of the government. You weren't going to be able to go take a Saturn V and use it for commercial purposes. And believe me, people tried to do that way back when. And those ventures were always turned down. So it was a 180 degree different world, but technology and computers and software and financing and inspiration and entrepreneurship have all changed, and it's a totally different world. And so these ventures are within our grasp now. So the Outer Space Treaty is an impediment. So you can try to modify it. It's the most signed treaty probably in the world. I don't know how you would modify it, because how could you get, you know, over 100 nations to agree on modifications in today's world, and especially through the United Nations?
Well, you can't get them to agree on anything.
That's right. So you can withdraw from the treaty with a one-year notice, but there's probably a lot of customary law from that treaty. So even if you withdrew from it, it's not clear that you would not still be subject to a lot of the articles that are in the Outer Space Treaty. So this idea of not having property rights is an impediment to deep space mining and resource utilization, to the point that Luxembourg, which has invested $250+ million with Planetary Resources, an American company, to go do deep space mining on the long haul, is now having their space law reviewed by their council of advisors, and they're saying, because there's no property rights, our entire law and position may be up in question. And so they are going to go to the United Nations. This is little tiny Luxembourg is going to go do this. And they're going to petition the United Nations to modify the damn Outer Space Treaty to allow for some sort of regimen of property rights so that mining resources can be done. And other countries are expected to join in and be supportive of Luxembourg. At the end of 2015, the U.S. passed the Commercial Space Act law of 2015, which gave modified property rights to all companies, even foreign companies, doing business in the United States that wanted to do some kind of business in the United States. It's very controversial. International space attorneys really oppose it, as do a lot of other countries that oppose it. It's not sure how valid that would be outside the United States, but they're attempting to put in place a mechanism where companies can get financing, they can raise money, they can get investors, they can start dealing with the legal difficulties of property rights so that they can do deep space mining. Now, if you resolve all of this, you still have the economic and the technical and the hardware issues and stuff like that, and the market issues for what it is you want to do. But this property rights and outer space treaty issues, these are really, really big issues, and they need to be resolved. And would President Trump withdraw us from the Outer Space Treaty? I probably don't think he would, but that's a possibility. He might, and might make some bold vision that says we're going out to space to make money, and we can't do it with the Outer Space Treaty, so this is what we're going to do. I wouldn't hold my breath for that, but a lot of people in the space industry, George, talk about that and hope that it would happen.
David, a story we have at coasttocoastam.com, one of our top stories, let me read you just a little bit of it. An astronomy professor at Penn State University has put forward a hypothesis that should sound familiar to UFO enthusiasts. In a recently published paper, the professor, James Wright, theorizes that Earth as well as Mars and Venus may have once been inhabited by technologically advanced extraterrestrials. What do you think of that?
First of all, I wish it were true, okay, because I love the subject. I don't do it on the space show, but I do love the subject. I would taunt back to the famous saying by Carl Sagan that if you're going to make extra special claims, you need a lot of extra special evidence. I mean, that's not the direct quote, but I'm sure you're familiar with.
Extraordinary claims.
Need extraordinary evidence.
Yeah.
And I would say stay grounded, and, you know, I'd like to see the guy's evidence for that, if there is any evidence for it. I don't know how you could ever confirm it, and that's always a problem. But if you are going to make really super duper claims, you better have the super duper evidence to back it up. And I don't know how you get that, but I would not shut my mind to it. I listen, there's a lot of strange things in this universe. Just look at Ceres, for example, from the Dawn mission, you know, the little asteroid out there. That thing is so strange and has so many unbelievable aspects about it,
yeah,
and water, ice, and things that have been coming in. And look at, you've got this new exoplanet that was discovered by an Earth-based telescope. And
was that the Proxima B?
Yeah, the one near it. And it's got an atmosphere that an Earth-based telescope did it. And now we've got two big Earth-based telescopes coming online in the next couple of years, and we're going to be able to determine exactly what is in that atmosphere, if there could be, you know, life-sustaining organics like we have here on Earth. And that's because it has an atmosphere, and Earth-based telescopes can read that atmosphere. So, you know, stuff is changing, and strange things are being found out. And I would say in 5 years, George, we'll be talking about things that we had no idea even existed today during this discussion.
When are we going to get to the point where we have, and I'm talking about through NASA, rockets to start launching things again?
Oh, boy.
Is it going to happen?
It is going to happen. So first of all, you do have that with SpaceX already. But if you want the government...
Yeah, but what would you say SpaceX's reliability is? 60%?
Well, no, they've done, 21 launches, and they've lost two of them, so...
All right, we'll do the math on that.
That's kind of par for a startup rocket. They're getting ready to start testing their Falcon Heavy, but they did some problem engineering, and they've got to redesign some of the central core stuff because the way they were strapping them together wasn't going to work. So they're going to have some delays on Falcon Heavy, but they're going to start doing some ground testing on Falcon Heavy in the near future, later this year. The government rocket, the big one that is controversial, is the SLS. And, you know, that's the really heavy lift big one, although the first part of the heavy lift one is a little bit smaller. So, you know, that's probably going to be delayed past 2018. I think as long as they don't kill the funding for it, I think it will fly, but it will be delayed. Will they actually find real missions for it? Will it be worth the billions and billions and billions of dollars that we're spending on it and that it will require for a standing army to maintain and launch it? I can't answer that question for you because I haven't seen any plans that show how this thing is seriously going to be used. I see and read a lot of rhetoric, but rhetoric doesn't equal policy or plan, and if you don't fund your policy or plan, you just have rhetoric. So SLS is kind of an unknown, but I do think it will fly, but I would imagine it's going to be delayed past 2018.
David, what do you think happened to Mars? I mean, it once had oceans. Who knows what kind of life it may or may not have had, but something catastrophic happened there. What happened?
Well, you know, they've got MAVEN going up there, and they're trying to find out what happened to the atmosphere on Mars. I really think that if we could put geologists on Mars rather than just total robotics, I think we'd find serious evidence or proof of past life on Mars.
I think you're right.
Now, it might just be simple molecular or biological, you know, molecules. I'm not saying it had sentient life on it. But something happened. I don't think we know all the answers to it yet. We do have probes that are out there trying to tell us, you know, what happened and where the atmosphere went. I think we know a lot more about that today than we did 2 years ago. But I can't answer that question. I think it is a key question. I strongly support the continued robotic exploration of Mars to answer these questions. But I really think, George, we need boots on the ground in some very key places with geologists who can, you know, instead of spending 5 years to go, a quarter mile, who can go a quarter mile in an hour and really make some progress exploring and looking for things and doing some excavating on Mars.
What drives you, David? How long have you been fascinated with space? I would guess since you were a little boy.
Yeah, of course. I used to look at the stars with a Cub Scout telescope in my backyard in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is where I grew up. I mean, you know, what kid didn't do things like that, you know? And the Cub Scout telescopes were pretty cool. You could see rings around Saturn and craters on the moon. And so I've always been interested. I love the 1950s sci-fi movies, you know, and the flying saucer movies, Earth versus Flying Saucers, all of that stuff. You know, when I got older and was in graduate school and was doing economics and stuff, and I wanted to put it to use with a passion, and I came across people who started talking to me about space tourism and Mars. This was 16, 17 years ago. And I saw an opportunity to sort of mesh my financial and business interests to my longtime passion for space, but take it out of the realm of science fiction, but, you know, more or less into the reality world. But I really think the path to a better life for everybody on this planet goes through space. So if you think about it, and you and I probably are around the same age, we grew up and the Cold War was on. I did duck and cover drills. You probably did that stuff too in school.
Oh, yeah.
We were doing Cuban Missile Crisis and all these problems, and yet we had peaceful relations with one another in space. And in fact, you see that going on now. We don't have a good relationship with Russia, and we're not gonna go into the politics of the U.S. and Russia, but it's not good. But man, on the space station, and when they're on the Soyuz together, and the cosmonaut crews and the astronaut crews, they get along like they're blood brothers. And so the path to a better world for everybody on this planet, even some poor slob in Syria who's had his home taken away by the terrorist and his family killed, goes through space. We've got better technology, we've got better communications, we've got medicine that you never dreamed of. We never dreamed of some of the things when we were kids that we can do in medicine today. And a lot of that comes from the electronics and the miniaturization and what's happened with space and other technology fields as well. So if we can hold humanity together and continue to develop and explore space, that is the path to a far, far better world for everybody living on this planet. It's going to improve our lives, our health, our cultures, everything. And so space, to me, is really, really crucial. And I think it's undervalued, and a lot of people don't understand it. They see it as a cost center rather than an asset mm-hmm. to invest in for the future. But it holds so many keys to a better world for all of us and to more opportunity. Can you imagine what it would do for our economies of the world if we had a cislunar economic infrastructure with hundreds of thousands of people and opportunities making money and creating jobs and doing things in space?
It would be huge.
I mean, it would be bigger than a lot of the industries that are here on Earth. And what's going on Earth, what are we seeing? We're seeing electronics take away brick-and-mortar stores. You know, I just, before we started this show, I was listening to what Amazon is doing and what the problems are with brick-and-mortar. But you can go down the line in everything. Where do we see any new industrial development coming? Where do we see new opportunity? Robotics and AI and 3D printing are taking jobs away from people. And they're, you know, they talk about giving people guaranteed incomes now because of so much job displacement from fourth industrial revolution type of techniques and manufacturing.
And it's going to get worse, David. It's going to get worse. We're going to come back in a moment. Our final hour with David Livingston. We'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.